But if you are given a sheep or a goat and told to distribute its meat, I take the kebabs for myself. That is, I give 10 speeches about justice, but in distributing the goats, I am not just, because I take this kebab for myself. God knows what we are. A person does not know himself. Therefore, the Quran says, your side today will be piercing. On the day of resurrection, when secrets are revealed, eyes will be opened. Your side will be iron. Your side today will be piercing, means your side on the day of resurrection will be iron. It will shock you. What? Was it me? I thought I was a good person. No, you are not good. Thank you very much, dear listeners of iRib English Radio, for listening to the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. To find out more about this program and our other programs, please log on to our website, iranradio.ir. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
welcome back to Attrition. I'm your host, Amar Kazmi, and I continue to be joined for part two of the show with British-Palestinian medical doctor Rahma Aladwar. Rahma, you've repeatedly said that we need to free Palestine and Britain from Jewish supremacy. So what's your analysis of how and why the British state has been captured by Zionists?
The Jewish lobby exerts its influence with coercion. So if they're not blackmailing, they are funding. If they're not funding, they are threatening. If they're not threatening, they're infiltrating. It is usually one of those things. How they captured my general medical counsel, I truly believe that my case was being put in the hands of people who were going to take them further. Dr. Rehana Ali is a great example of this. Her case was rejected, the exact same complaint was rejected, I think, 2 to 3 times before it was put in the right hands of that person, that investigation officer, that case examiner, who then brought it forwards. So that's infiltration. That is Jewish supremacists, whether they're Jews or non-Jews, but they are enforcing Jewish supremacy inside our institutions. MPs-wise, they're funded, but not only just funded. You know, Wesley Streeting has been basically groomed by the Jewish lobby since he was young. When he was at uni, the Jewish Chronicle printed an article to say that he was their friend at the NUS.
The National Union of Students.
Yeah. Wesley Streeting is a case in point, because I think obviously right now there's talks about potentially him taking over from Keir Starmer. I think if Wesley Streeting in any way, shape or form becomes Prime Minister in Britain, then you know Britain is absolutely completely controlled by Israel and the Jewish lobby, because he has been fully groomed from when he was younger. They take them on trips to Israel. That's another key thing. So many of our MPs, through Labour Friends of Israel and Conservative Friends of Israel, they take our British MPs to that entity. God knows what they do there, but they come back and then it becomes Israel first. It is just no longer Britain first. You know, there's videos of Nandi.
Lisa Nandi.
Yeah, from 2018, talking about Palestine. And then now she's like, Israel first. You know, she refuses to even speak about Palestine
and she was also previously chair of Labour Friends of Palestine as well.
Exactly. So something happens there, and it's usually that trip and some money.
And the issue you raised of coercion, intimidation, blackmail is very important, because quite clearly, if you don't fall in line and support the Zionist regime, these lobby groups have the power to harass, intimidate, to destroy your career. And we see with your case how they've tried to destroy your medical career. And so if you want to get on in British public life, it seems that you have to be a Zionist, and also to go on the offensive against Muslims, Palestinians and Arabs.
Well, totally. You know, this is far beyond me as a person, far beyond me with my medical license. I think if any lobby group is able to ruin the life of a doctor in a nation who has not harmed anybody and not broken any law, then we're in a lot of trouble. If they can do that to me, then any British citizen is next. You know, this is the end of free speech in Britain. You know, this is the demise of our, not only our independence, that's already gone. We're already captured. But this is now about our ability to speak freely, our freedom of assembly, our freedom of speech and expression. That is what is right now being attacked in Britain by the Jewish lobby.
Hmm. I want to get into the details of the General Medical Council's case against you. I appreciate that there's a lot to recap, but could you explain, in summary, the level of harassment that you've been facing with this case?
Sure. You said the General Medical Council's sort of campaign against me. It is It might appear that way, but I think it's literally me versus the Jewish lobby, because the General Medical Council is just, it's not an independent regulator. So they initiated an investigation on me last year. That was 9 months long. I responded, case closed, no outcome. They had to tell lawyers for Israel, she's not a quote-unquote anti-Semite, and she's not a terrorist supporter, so that's it. Then, again, this is the incessant harassment and complaints of the Jewish lobby. They kept going and harassing the General Medical Council. A second investigation was opened in May this year, 2025. But this time, even worse, they kept complaining to the point where the GMC referred me to what is called an interim orders tribunal hearing, which is an emergency. It is an extreme measure where the General Medical Council go, well, we're investigating you for these allegations, but as we investigate you, actually we think you should be suspended or you should have conditions placed on your practice. So that happened. I went to the hearing on the 25th of September and I defended with my legal team. I defended a bundle of about 450 pages and I came out and the panel found no reason to place any order on my practice. So I won that. 12 days later, the General Medical Council re-refer me again to this hearing, this emergency hearing that actually a lot of doctors who have actually physically harmed patients through their practice might never actually be referred to an IOT hearing. That's where I am at the moment. So I'm facing a second IOT hearing in my second investigation for exactly the same issues that the Jewish lobby does not like. And all this shows is that I have been exonerated at every single level of investigation up until today. I've won everything against them, yet somehow I'm still being painted as this evil villain.
And you've said that these IOT hearings, these interim orders tribunal hearings, are only for really extreme cases in relation to patient care. But in your case, it's purely in relation to social media posts.
So the IOT hearing is an emergency measure because it is saying that whilst the GMC investigate, you can't practice as a doctor, which means that the GMC, through the tribunal, will remove you from being able to care for the British public. That's why it's an extreme measure, because whilst you investigate, you're saying that whether this takes 2 months or 9 months like my first, this doctor is not able to treat the British public and care for them. That's an extreme because that is a negative for the British public. But the GMC are willing to do that and to take moral doctors away from the British public because the Jewish lobby says so. I think that's why it's I don't think people understand why it is an emergency measure. There's incidents where doctors are being investigated for misconduct, for potential patient harm, for alleged inappropriateness, with patients who might not get an IOT hearing. Yet I am being referred for a second one, again for a speech for like you say, social media. It's making a mockery of our medical regulation.
Well, I think your case really highlights the nature of Jewish supremacy in Britain, because you can just contrast the way that you've been treated with the way that some other Jewish doctors have been treated. So if we take the case of Dr. Justin Stebbing, in 2020, he was investigated by the General Medical Council over allegations that he failed to provide adequate care to 11 patients that he cared for. He admitted to 30 of the 36 charges against him. He was found guilty of another three. He was found to have inappropriately treated patients given their poor prognosis, overstated life expectancy and benefits of treatment, failed to gain informed consent by not discussing the risks and benefits of treatments, and failed to maintain proper records. He was also found to have engaged in inappropriate communications with a female patient. but he was only suspended for 9 months and he wasn't even struck off and he didn't even get referred to an IOT hearing like you've been. And then you have Dr. Liz Lightstone, who, in my view, has engaged in open Islamophobia and denial of the genocide in Gaza, but no action has been taken against her. This is a two-tier system, isn't it?
The two-tier system in Britain is that there is one treatment for Jews and another for non-Jews. That is what my case highlights very, very clearly. You mentioned the two Jewish doctors, Justin Stebbing and Liz Lightstone. Despite what you've mentioned with their misconduct, and I call it anti-Muslim hatred, I don't like the term Islamophobia either. So yeah, it's not just the terms about, you know, Jews that I contest. But they have the chutzpah, the audacity, to complain about me. Those are the two complaints. Justin Stebbing is who kick-started my second investigation.
Well, it was remiss of me to not mention that, actually, that Dr. Justin Stebbing is one of the prime complainants against you. And as you say, he has the sheer audacity, the chutzpah, to be complaining about you when he was found guilty of misconduct in the course of his practice as a doctor, not for social media posts.
Yeah, it is the chutzpah. You know, him and Liz Lightstone, I wouldn't want them anywhere near me or my loved ones. Straight, you know, I am not afraid to say quite loud and clearly that if there is a Israeli or a part Israeli British doctor, I do not want them anywhere near me or my loved ones. And if there's a doctor that supports, you know, who supports Israel, I too do not want them any. I don't want them anywhere near me in terms of medical treatment, because I think having that position is the most sort of antithetical to our medical ethics. But yeah, those two doctors, one of them Stebbing, you know, a record of misconduct and terrible behavior and dishonesty, recurrent dishonesty. That's what the MPTS actually said about him, that he was consistently dishonest. And that is what he wrote for me in the complaint that he made to the GMC. He called me dishonest.
Every accusation is a confession when it comes to the Zionists.
100%. It is just such Jew supremacist behavior. Liz Lightstone, I did, I think, two posts about her atrocious justification or alleged justification of murdering Palestinian journalists and medics, and she went ahead and complained about me. So there's a complaint from her in this bundle now from Liz Lightstone, and she sent that complaint while she was holidaying in the terrorist entity. It is just, oh, and another one is Dr. Miriam Green. She is the Jewish doctor that I worked with at the Whittington last year, who went behind my back. I didn't know that she did this, but she complained to the Whittington. She complained to my seniors. She was my junior, right? Never had an issue with her face to face. She complained to my trust. She complained to my seniors. She lied about me in the Daily Mail with the Sabrina Miller article, which ended up creating this huge campaign against me, getting me doxxed, me having to call the police. Dr. Miriam Green, I mentioned her when I defended myself against her lies in the Daily Mail. She called the police, saying that I was sort of sharing her details online when I was defending myself against her lies. And not only that, she complained to the Jewish Medical Association, who, in their complaint last time, said that I was doxing her, that I doxed Miriam Green. Miriam Green, who got me sacked from the Whittington, who lied about me in the Daily Mail, getting me to the point where I feared for my life and my family's life, and who called the police on me for defending myself against her. Apparently I'm doxing her. So I'm going to continue to say her name because it's not doxing, it is my, it just shows you the arrogance, the behavior, the feeling untouchable. You know, that is somebody I wouldn't want to care for me or my loved ones, you know. And not just that, after my hearing, now for this second hearing, lawyers for Israel are also saying that I'm harassing and doxing Miriam Green. It just comes up constantly, even though I made a few posts about her.
I mean, this type of behavior is absolutely typical of Zionists. I mean, I mentioned before that every accusation is a confession, and that they perpetuate a position of victimhood while actually being perpetrators of aggression against others. We should also talk about your arrest on the 18th of October. This was just days before you had a tribunal hearing. It's quite clear to me that you were arrested at the behest of the Israel lobby and probably also the British Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, who, in my view, is a Zionist fanatic and an asset of the Zionist regime. I just want to read out some of what the arresting officer said, because it's pretty sinister. So they started by saying, on the 21st of July, at a pro-Palestine protest which took place outside of the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, you gave a speech which amounted to calls for the eradication of Israel and implied support for all those involved in armed resistance against Israel, including organizations such as Hamas. So firstly, it's not illegal to call for the eradication of a nation state, and it's also perfectly lawful to support armed resistance against the Zionist state, because Palestinians have that right under international law. They then started talking about the pro-Israel MP Wes Streeting, and they also said that you were being arrested for comments directed at him that could be interpreted as anti-Semitic, including anti-Semitic tropes, which could be grossly offensive in character. I mean, Wes Streeting isn't even Jewish, so it's very, very strange. And then they said, on the 7th of October, you posted a variety of communications which demonstrated support for Hamas's attack on Israel. So, firstly, it wasn't a Hamas attack. It was actually a coordinated operation between all factions of the Palestinian resistance, including the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the PFLP, which is not prescribed in Britain, and also its armed wing is not prescribed in Britain. They then carried on, an attack which involved murder, rape, even though there's zero evidence of rape, right? That's just blatant atrocity propaganda. And then they continued, and kidnap of Israeli citizens, which could be considered grossly offensive in character. This looks like a charge sheet written directly by the Zionist state, or indeed by Wes Streeting, on their behalf, and then sent to the police. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, totally. My arrest 2 days before my hearing was completely ordered by either straight from Tel Aviv, or at least certainly from the Jewish lobby in Britain. The police were just pawns. You know, there is just no British independence. We don't have a sovereign Britain. The allegations that the police said, if you change Israel for Britain, I wouldn't have been arrested. I could have said that I don't want Britain to exist, and I could have made all of those remarks about Britain. I would not have been arrested. That is Jewish supremacy. I could, you know, that is the two tier. But the British state is allowing itself to just be used by this power to enforce something that Jewish supremacy only benefits 0.4% of the British population, because 0.4% are Jewish. Now, obviously, some of those Jews might not engage in Jewish supremacy, but it's still there, open for them. So I think it's time that the British public kind of wakes up to this. You have a doctor who is British, who has never harmed a patient, who has an unblemished record, being doxxed, harassed, smeared, arrested for a foreign entity. And now we are looking at potential changes to the law because of Wesley Streeting saying that you are guilty before you're innocent. If you're accused of anti-Semitism only, you can be accused of being a murderer or a rapist, but you are innocent until you're found guilty. But if you're accused of anti-Semitism, then you will, in the NHS, you will be guilty, you'll be suspended whilst you're being investigated. That couldn't be anything but Jewish supremacy. And he's meddling into our independent panels. So There's no finality of justice if you're found to be innocent, but, you know, Jewish supremacists think, nope, you're guilty. Our politicians and our institutions will retry you. And if the Jewish lobby is not happy with you, if you're threatening, if you're saying things that threatens their supremacy, then you're guilty before you're found innocent. I mean, that's outrageous.
I just want to add something briefly about that in terms of West Streeting's intervention. Number one, he's the health secretary. He's a member of the British government. If we're supposed to have a separation of powers, then why is he meddling in the internal affairs of a professional regulator and how they decide to govern the medical profession? But nevertheless, he appears to have threatened legal action if they don't give him the decision that he wants. And in response to your victory at the Interim Orders Tribunal, before they re-referred you to another tribunal, he announced a government review on tackling anti-Semitism and other forms of racism in the NHS. And who did he appoint to conduct that review? He appointed the Zionist zealot Lord John Mann. Now, John Mann, until 2021, and he might have accepted more donations since then, but what I know is that during his long political career, until 2021, he'd accepted £36,815.92 in donations and junkets from the Israel lobby. And this is the person who has now been put in charge of a review into supposed anti-Semitism in the NHS directly because of your victory. So that just gives you an indication of the state of things. But I want to steer away from all of that now and lastly speak about the Thawabit. So these are the red lines in campaigning for Palestinian liberation. Could you just explain, for the benefit of our viewers, what are the Thawabit and why should we insist on them in the campaigning that we do here in the West?
The Thawabit are the non-negotiables, or the constants, the red lines of Palestinian liberation. They're derived from the Palestinian National Charter that has 33 articles. This is what they don't want you to know about. The Palestinian National Charter was agreed on in 1968 by all Palestinian factions and the Arab League. And it is the most pure, authentic Palestinian nationalist voice. And that is what the Palestinian National Charter lists, what is required in order to have national freedom and sovereignty in Palestine by Palestinians. It contains all the answers that anybody could have to questions that they may go and ask maybe a liberal or, you know, somebody in the West. Palestinians have already set that out. If you asked most people in the movement, in the Palestine movement in the West, if they have read those 33 articles, when I say article, it's just a few lines each, in the Palestinian National Charter, I doubt that many of them would have. And that is where I think the movement has been subverted. And those articles are what we derive the Thawabit from. The Thawabit are basically four principles. It can be four to six, depending how you word them, that are just non-negotiable. This is how Palestinians have set out their liberation. Number one, Palestine. What was the British mandate of Palestine? That is the Palestinian map, and it is not divisible. You can't partition that. That is Palestine. It is Arab. From the river to the sea, the entire thing is for Palestinians. And its capital is Al-Quds, Jerusalem. And the Palestinian people believe in armed struggle and actually believe that that is the way to liberate Palestine. The Palestinian people reject normalization. And the right of return for all Palestinians to Palestine, that includes, you know, over 7 million Palestinians. And within that, that encompasses who stays. And the Palestinians have already said that the Jews who were in Palestine before the Jew supremacists, the Zionist project started, are Palestinian Jews. So they are counted as Palestinian, but not the rest.
Well, thank you so much for that, Dr. Rahma. I really appreciate you sharing your insights with me. I'm afraid that we've run out of time, but thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been great.
And thank you. See you next time.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough. Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar. A lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
So, brothers and sisters, Allah has favored us uniquely by being able to be here for another Fatimiyah. That's a blessing that we don't want to kind of take lightly. We might not be able to fully grasp just how important these opportunities are, but those who have recently left this world, they could tell us just how important these gatherings are. Allow me to recite one hadith just so you and I, again, will maybe appreciate the tawfiq of being in this gathering. So our prophet is speaking to Salman. He says, Ya Salman, hubbu Fatima yanfa'u fi mi'ati mawtin. Salman, the love of Fatima is beneficial in 100 places. In 100 places. He continues by speaking, And he says, the least of these places, the least of these places are the following. Al-maut, when we die. Wal-qabr, when we're in our graves. Wal-mizan, when they are weighing our a'mal. Wal-mahshar, on yawm al-qiyamah. Was-sirat, when we have to pass the sirat. Wal-muhasaba, when they are taking account of us. At those times, our love of Fatima will come to our rescue. We will be so happy we were amongst her followers. So, I want to share just again, because again, we're asking for something big. Salman is the person who's Salman al-Muhammadi, right? Salman is someone paradise long for him. And Ayatollah Behzad is telling us, we can all be Salman. It's a choice. Is it really even something we can actually say to Fatima for? Yes. I want to share a little bit about her status, her unique status with God, just to kind of give us the encouragement to ask Allah for these things, and then after that to get into the actual talk. So we're referring to someone, we talk about our mother Sayyida Fatima, whose spiritual personality towers over spiritual giants like Nabi Nuh, like Nabi Isa. Her status is more than that of Nabi Ibrahim. I want to mention a hadith just about her status. So inshallah, we pray, we ask, but then with iman, knowing that this can happen. It goes both ways. This is now about Sayyida Fatima. So our prophet is speaking about our mother. He says this, Ya Fatima, al-bushra, good tidings. Falaki, inda Allah, maqamun mahmud. You have a praiseworthy station with God. He says, Tashfa'ina fi limuhibbik wa shi'atik. You are able to do, you will do, shafa'a for those who love you and those who are your shia. Fatu shafa'in. The wonderful part is your intercession will be accepted. So Sayyida Fatima, her position with God is that great. She can literally do miracles. And the leader says that he would save up his hajat for these days and nights. It's because it's a reality. But it works both ways. Both for those who she hates. Well, let me share this part of the hadith too. He says, Ya Fatima, لو أن كل نبي بعثه الله. Fatima, if every prophet, every Nabi that God ever sent, وَكُلُّ مَلَكٍ قَرَّبَهُ, and every single one of the malaika that Allah brought nigh, so every Nabi and every one of the malaika, if they did شَفَعُوا فِي كُلِّ مُبْغِذٍ لَكِ, if they were to try to intercede for those who hate you, Ghasibin laki, those who had stolen your right, he says, Ma akhrajahu Allah min an-nar abada. Allah would never take them out of hell. Her status is that high. Every single Nabi were to gather and try to remove. No. Right? So this kind of a personality, our mother, we're now trying to go and benefit from her. If Allah grants us what we're looking for, this Fatimiyya, then we can be game changers for the Mahdi. Game changers for the Mahdi. Now you and I, because we've been over this before, this is just an ishara, just to kind of get us where we're trying to go. We remember that the story of Sayyida Fatima is not just about a few bad apples. There were a few people who went rogue and everybody else was okay. No. There was a community of people who watched, who were indifferent, who said, this isn't my fight. A community of people. However, when Amirul Mu'mineen speaks, and he's talking about how he was forced to make bay'ah, he names certain individuals, certain Mu'mineen, such individuals with towering faith. He says, if these people were there, I would have never been forced to make bay'ah. This is from Middle Mu'mineen. He says, لو كان بعد رسول الله, if it were the case that after the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he says, عمي حمزة وأخي جعفر, if I had these two individuals, no one would have been able to force me to make bay'ah. So, if we do get the results, that deep connection with God, to really be a mu'min, if that's what we're able to get out, then we'll be able to change the course of history and really be able to benefit the cause. So now we're about to begin our journey to that deep, satisfying, emotional relationship with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. To whet our appetites, I'd like to talk a little bit about what the Ahlul Bayt have said about divine love. At least we know what we're praying for. This is from Imam Sajjad. So Imam Sajjad has a very beautiful dua. It's going to let us know what we're trying to get to. This is what the Imam says. Ilahi, O Allah, man dhalladhi dhaqa halawata mahabbatik. Tell me, O Allah, is there anyone who tasted the sweetness of your love? Tasted, the words of the Imam, who tasted the sweetness of your love, farama minka badala. And after that, the person literally wanted something else, someone else, something else. If a person can taste divine love, they're going to be a different person. The hadith is this. This is from Imam Baqir. He says this, Wallahi, he swears by Allah, ma yanju min adham, no one can escape a sin, illa man aqarra bih, except for the person who admits that there's a problem. If I can admit that there's a problem, if I can ask these questions in all honesty of myself and then admit, yes, there is a problem. There is room for growth. These ayat of the Quran are talking to me. Then the growth can happen.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen.
Thank you.
You are listening to Iran Radio, and we are so glad to have you on this part of our schedule. And here are some interesting facts about Islam. Let's listen. Islam is the world's second largest religion, and it is a monotheistic faith with about 1.8 billion followers worldwide, originating in Mecca during the life of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of Allah upon him and his progeny. Islam means submission to the will of Allah, and its followers are called Muslims. Muslims believe in one God, Allah, who is the creator of all things and has no partners or equals. The Quran is the holy book of Islam, believed to be the literal word of Allah revealed to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of Allah upon him and his progeny. Muslims adhere to the five pillars of Islam: Shahada, or declaration of faith; Salah, or prayer; Zakat, or charity; Saum, or fasting during Ramadan; and Hajj, or pilgrimage to Mecca. The Islamic year is 11 days shorter than the year used in the Western world. This is because the Western year is based on the orbit of the Earth around the sun instead of on the phases of the moon. And we'll listen to continuation of Iran Radio. First, we bring you a new edition of Round the World with reporters. Then Radio Productions returns with more engaging content. Then stay with us for the Keys of Life. In this enriching segment, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musavi presents significance into the Islamic way of living, inspired by Mafatihul Hayat, the profound work of Ayatollah Javadi Amali. Each episode offers practical guidance rooted in spirituality and ethics, helping us live with purpose, compassion, and clarity. Coming up, it's time for Round the World with Reporters. Don't go anywhere.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the World with Reporters.
The recent launch of a Muslim association aspiring to be registered as a political party has caused an uproar in Italy. The association, named MURO 27, the acronym for Muslims for Rome, aims to participate in the 2027 mayoral elections in the Italian capital, Rome. Following the announcement of the new association, several Italian media close to Italy's ruling right coalition and some anti-immigrant League party members have slammed the initiative as a threat to Italy's liberal institutions, a project that, quote, aims to plant the crescent flag on Rome's Capitol Hill.
This initiative has been immediately exploited by some anti-immigrant, anti-Islam parties for political gain. Having said that, the initiators of this association should have involved the whole of the Muslim community.
I am of the idea that such initiatives are welcomed when they are in the public interest. Many Italians are very wary of traditional politics, but I am afraid they are not ready to support a Muslim candidate, as recently happened in New York.
The MURO 27 Association has been funded by a group of Muslims led by Francesco Thieri, an Italian engineer who converted to Islam about 20 years ago when he added to his name that of Abd al-Haq, one of the names of God in the Quran. Thieri already ran as a candidate in Rome's 2021 local elections. The Italian capital is home to about 120,000 Muslims, 40,000 of whom are Italian citizens.
Islam is not formally recognized as a religion in Italy, despite 1.5 million Muslims live in the country. Furthermore, the organizations representing Muslims are also not legally recognized by the Italian state, albeit Muslims have the constitutional right to practice their religion.
tuttora la questione della presenza.
To this day, the issue of the Muslims in Italy has been solely tackled with security policies, overlooking the political, social, and cultural dimensions of our religion. As for the new association, it's not clear yet, in my view, what the nature and the goals of this initiative are.
Strangely enough, Italy already has a Muslim mayor, but no controversy has been raised about his election. It is Moreno Marzetti, an Italian convert, who also is a member of the anti-Islam, anti-immigrant League party. He was elected as mayor of Italy's northern town of Malo in 2020. Max Civili, Press TV, Rome.
A new report submitted to the United States Congress has reignited debate over China's rising defense capabilities. Citing Pakistan's battlefield performance during the May conflict, the assessment notes Islamabad's effective use of Chinese-supplied weaponry. The congressional report highlights that the systems sourced from China played a decisive role in Pakistan's recent military success, pointing to Beijing's steadily advancing defense industry. The findings are seen by analysts as a sign that Chinese platforms, long dismissed in Washington as second tier, are now demonstrating reliability and precision in real conflict scenarios. Islamabad's expanding partnership with Beijing through joint exercises and coordinated training reinforces this shift.
Without a doubt, China has surprised the world. However, China's weapons and technology are not yet tested. China has not been involved in as many wars as the USA, so their technology will be new and surprising, but we cannot say for certain they can outclass US technology.
These trends come at a moment when the United States is expanding its own deployments in South Korea and Japan and intensifying patrols in the South China Sea. Regional observers say the growing China-Pakistan alignment is complicating Washington's broader strategy to contain Beijing's military rise. For Pakistan, the cooperation offers technological upgrades and strategic diversification, while for China, it signals greater influence across South and West Asia.
China is an emerging superpower, whether it is in terms of their economy or the speed of their jets. Their recent military parade shocked the world. President Xi Jinping was there too. They have changed the power dynamics of the region and definitely the world too.
From Islamabad's perspective, the message is straightforward. China's defense edge is becoming harder for Washington to ignore. And Pakistan's cooperation with Beijing is now part of that shifting balance. Anna Muhyiddin, Islamabad.
Wahdat Hall served as the venue for Iran's National Heroes Day. The event brought together people, including families of martyrs, officials and writers, to honor their heroes and reminisce about their legacy.
The key component of our strength lies in the role of families and women. Their support for the fighters ultimately contributes to hero-making and to the transmission of a culture of resistance to future generations.
Across Iran, people find heroism in those who gave their lives for the Islamic Revolution, the 8 years sacred defense, the nation's nuclear and missile programs, the fight against US-backed Daesh, and the 12-day defense against the US and the Zionist regime, offering the world a different definition of a hero.
The works produced in the literature of the sacred defense are of an enlightening and motivating nature, which is the same quality that contributed to the early spread of Islam.
The program was further enriched by the unveiling of three commendations written by the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on the lives of three martyrs.
The book Endless Fever not only recounts the life of a paraplegic veteran, but also portrays the way a family confronts and copes with this situation.
It was God's will that I became the mother of a martyr, and I must express my gratitude to all mothers of martyrs for raising such children.
The young companions of Martyr Soleimani, who sacrificed themselves to fight terrorism and imperialist schemes, perhaps serve as the strongest proof that the future generations of Iran will continue the path of resistance.
The National Heroes Day is named for the day when Martyr Soleimani's letter to Ayatollah Khamenei marked the annihilation of Daesh. 8 years later, Iranians continue to resist oppression, whether through literature or on the battlefield. Moin Amini, Tehran.
The scale of military spending across the 27-member European Union is staggering. On Wednesday, the bloc's executive arm, the European Commission, unveiled a new wave of major defense initiatives.
During the next 10 years, there will be around 6.8 trillion euros spent by member states for defense.
At the same time, more than 93 million EU citizens remain at risk of poverty, roughly 21% of the population. We put these figures to officials at Wednesday's defense briefing.
How do we justify this huge amount of money that we're spending in terms of military?
Of course, every government needs to spend on education, social affairs, everything. You know, the needs are enormous. The trouble is that, you know, if you have, you know, infrastructure attacked, if you have, you know, schools and hospitals attacked like they are right now in Ukraine, all of this doesn't matter if you're not able to defend what you have.
Since 2022, the EU has directed 177 billion euro toward Ukraine, much of it supporting Kiev's military effort. We asked members of the public for their views on military spending versus social investment.
The public support is not there, so I do think we need to strike a better balance and listen a bit better to the population.
It doesn't help either when you mention about this corruption, the latest corruption scandal in Ukraine. It kind of, that sways public opinion as well.
No, for sure. Yeah, no, I think that's people start asking questions, and rightly so.
It is very important to focus on the social crisis we're in right now. And so many people are not, like, they don't have their rights looked after, and that is should be a primary concern.
If you don't have defense capabilities and if you don't have deterrence, then you cannot really expect to cover all the any of the other aspects either, because if you don't have the basic safety in the society, then everything else falls wayside as well.
As the Commission pushes ahead with its plans for record military spending, the political risk is unmistakable.